4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene, where we feature stories and conversations about planetary change. I'm Leslie Chang. Today on the show, we're featuring a conversation with environmental journalist Andy Revkin. Stay tuned afterwards for a short special segment about a new book on the Anthropocene by David Biello titled The Unnatural World. Our first story is with Andy Revkin. He's an award-winning journalist who has been writing about environmental issues for more than three decades. For the past several years, Andy has written the popular New York Times blog, Dot Earth. And as it turns out, he's also in the Anthropocene Working Group. In addition, he co-hosts the podcast Warm Regards, which tackles climate change from a lot of different angles. Andy happened to be in the Bay Area a few weeks ago, so our producer, Mike Osborne, took the opportunity to meet up with him. They actually recorded this a few days before Andy took a new position writing for ProPublica. So here is Mike and Andy's conversation.
I am Andrew Revkin. I have been writing for the New York Times in one way or another for 20 years. Since 2010, on a freelance basis, writing my blog, .earth, which got started when I was still a news reporter at the Times, as a way to explore this question of the Anthropocene, which is how do we navigate the next 100 years without totally screwing up? And that's a question that's really hard to answer in a standard newspaper article.
How do we not screw up the planet for the next 100 years?
Yeah, because it's a little amorphous. It's basically every question. It's questions like how much nature is enough? That's a tough question, but that's a question we have to answer going forward. How much warming is too much? It's not as simplistic as the number 2 degrees or 1.5. It depends on where you are in the world. It depends on your stage of development. I've been teaching this past 6 years also after I left the staff of the New York Times at Pace University. Mm-hmm. But my life is an open book going forward in terms of I'm always trying to figure out. And actually, the older you get, the more work you put into the question of how do I want to spend my time? What's the best use of the time I have left?
Huh.
And I turned 60 this year, and so you definitely look, we're juggling those questions at every stage of life. But as you get older, they get more intense because you realize your life is a story with a beginning and a middle and an end, and some of it will sort of transmute into someone else's story going forward, whether it's a student or a offspring or society at large. And those are all, again, it's kind of like those big questions of navigating the Anthropocene, navigating a life becomes more and more more intense the further you get into it.
That got big and philosophical really quick. That's awesome.
I guess it did. Yeah. Well, I've been thinking a lot about that stuff lately.
So. Yeah. But I would imagine the number 60 kind of looms large in your head.
Yeah,
one way, it's just another day, but like, okay, 60, I got to get your head around that.
Yeah, well, in 2011, I had a stroke.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, which definitely, and the first piece I did while I was in the hospital was on sustainability, but I think the first line was, you can't focus on sustaining the planet unless you sustain yourself first. And that was my first real sort of encounter with mortality. And we tend to tamp those things down and then, hello.
Yeah, wow.
This is your brain talking. It just reminds you, we mostly wall off mortality. Hmm. And we mostly wall off things like climate change because they're so big and momentous. And so much of what's happening with climate change is out of our control, including the world's control. It's not just a sense of each person having limited power. So much of it, as I've learned through a lot of reporting, is just a fundamental. For the moment, our potency has gotten way out in front of our awareness of not just the impacts of these things on long time scales, but our awareness of our own limitations as human beings, you know, and how we perceive risk and all that stuff.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, the perceptual and emotional experience of climate change is very it's very difficult to internalize, maybe impossible. I've wondered about that. I want to get into that in a sec. But I'd like to back up and actually sort of learn how you got into environmental reporting in the first place. I mean, you're from Rhode Island, right?
Yeah, well, Rhode Island is the ocean state. It's really easy to get to the beach and get in the ocean. And I grew up with Jacques Cousteau on TV with his French accent and his red beret that would stick a camera underwater and go, ooh la la. And, you know, to me, that was like incredibly exciting. But then in Rhode Island, I had the capacity to put on a mask and snorkel. The one bar mitzvah present I remember profoundly always was this family gave me a U.S. diver's mask and snorkel, and that was Jacques Cousteau's company, because he co-invented the regulator for scuba. And just the fact that I now had his gear and could kind of go stick my head underwater, and I could, you know, I saw amazing things right away, like a baby lobster one day. You know, I literally would get into kind of a hypnotic state underwater. And so I wanted to be a marine biologist, and I ended up at Brown University, the local school, majored in biology. Thought about medical school for like a year, but then organic chemistry sort of said, you will not be a doctor.
Right.
And then I was getting out and not quite sure what to do. And this is where the journalism starts to come in to play. I got this traveling fellowship that they had, three students a year had the chance to go somewhere in the world and do something weird. And my proposal, which I cobbled together very quickly, was to study men's relationship to the sea and to go to three island communities around the world and see if there were common elements when it's just you and the sea, you know. Mm. And it was a very romantic idea, and the committee obviously liked it. And I had researched one particular place in depth in French Polynesia. So here I am, you know, graduated. This is like 1978. That fall, I went to French Polynesia. I went to this little tiny village at the end of this road on an island, Raiatea, in French Polynesia. It was an amazing experience. Coral splendor, simple life, you know, family. You get up before dawn, the kids would wash and get ready for school. No electricity, except the Chinese family that owned the store in the village had electricity. And we would go prepare the soil up on the volcanic slope for planting the sweet potatoes and, you know, go fishing at night and learn how to catch the bait fish to catch the big fish. And, you know, so
it's
it was like
a storybook. Yeah.
It was really amazing.
How long were you there for?
I was there for about 2 months.
That's long enough to kind of immerse.
Oh, yeah. And to slow down. And for me, you know, suburbanite from New England, it was just like, this is paradise, right? Then I migrated further west to Fiji, New Caledonia. I went down to New Zealand. But here's what really happened. I was wandering the docks, and there was a sign in Auckland on the bulletin board that said, crew wanted, yacht wanderlust, inquire Marsden Wharf. And so I wandered down there, and there's this boat, and the skipper on the boat was from Santa Cruz, Lon Bubeck. First mate was also from Santa Cruz, Fuzz Ward, and the owner wasn't around at that time.
And Lon Bubeck and Fuzz Ward?
Yeah.
Those are great names.
Yeah, yeah, and they were like hippies but with skills,
you know,
they were taking the boat for the owner around the world. The boat was built in Sacramento, very funky. And I got signed on as first mate basically because I'd sailed before, you know, and, I wasn't being paid, but it wasn't costing me anything. And we were going to sail around the world. So I joined the crew of the sailboat. I sent a letter to my parents and I sent a letter to, Brown University saying, well, I'm going to be studying man's relationship to the sea, but in a more up-close way.
Yeah, this time on a boat.
Yeah, and we sailed off. And so then I was basically on that boat for almost a year and a half. We sailed two-thirds of the way around the world.
Holy cow.
15 countries, 17,000 miles. I left the boat in what was then Yugoslavia in 1980. And that trip made me want to be a journalist and to get back to the real world. And I'd seen things, I'd photographed fascinating and troubling things in Djibouti, the base of the Red Sea, after we crossed the Western Indian Ocean from Maldives. I was in the Maldives, which now are known as the poster child for sinking islands.
Right.
But in Djibouti, there was this pile of at a tobacco shop on a corner, there was a pile of leopard skins for sale, like there were several dozen leopard skins. And, you know, I took this picture suddenly. That was my first real sort of integrated notion of something being unsustainable. You know, I was 1980, and I just, again, those kinds of things started fixating me and spent a little time trying to figure out what to do and ended up at journalism school. Science journalism in the early 80s was kind of a booming actual industry. You know, it was a promising way to make a living.
I'm jealous, yeah.
I know. You know, it's not the space shuttle was ascendant. This the personal computer. You know, it was a go-go time for science writing.
Yeah.
And I got hired. My first job after journalism school was taking a sailboat along the New England coast for the summer, writing stories about the New England coast for a boating magazine.
Wow.
So I drew on that experience there, but I ended up at Science Digest magazine in 1983. And kind of a copy editing job, you know, and making minimal money. But the editor-in-chief at the time, Scott DeGarmo, he let me start reporting some feature stories right away. And that got me going. My first magazine feature came out in 1983, won an Investigative Reporters and Editors Award.
So, wow. What was it about?
Paraquat, the herbicide, the weed killer paraquat, which I had stumbled into as killing a lot of people. It's a brown liquid. It was often stored improperly, and people would drink it accidentally or, in some cases, drink it intentionally as a suicide, means of suicide. And this is before the internet. You know, I sort of stumbled into some of these hints that there was a problem here. And I spent weeks of spare time while I was copy editing other people's articles, you know, calling phoning the Thailand's, health department, saying, so how many deaths have you seen there from paraquat poisoning? And then phoning the one in India and phoning the one in Kenya. And, you know, over time, I had assembled enough evidence. There were 1,000 or two deaths a year worldwide from this. And, you know, where's the industry's responsibility to make sure something stays labeled? And so it ended up being a really, really interesting article. And that led me, you know, launched my writing career. And then climate came just two years later, 1985, my first big story on climate change.
So I want to ask about that. I mean, you know, as a former grad student, as a recovering scientist, you hear about the history of people, you know, sort of wrestling with some of the questions in the 60s and 70s about, the oncoming ice age. And then, you know, you also hear about Arrhenius and all these people who have known about the effect of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases going back for a long, long way.
Sure.
In terms of the sort of science journalism community, when did awareness that, like, oh, we've got a big issue that's sort of not out there, like, when did you start talking with colleagues, not necessarily other scientists, but I'm kind of curious because I know, you know, eventually we get James Hansen testifying before Congress in whatever it was, 88, is that what it was? Yeah. But in the years leading up to that, I'm kind of curious about the culture, the conversation, how much people knew, and does that question make sense?
Yeah. The New York Times had already written about it off and on for quite a while. I recently did a piece on Dot Earth going back, you know, 100 years. You can find newspaper articles from 1912 that really crystallized the idea.
Saw that,
as you were saying. But I think for journalism, it really was around 88 when it became a big story. And it was partially Jim Hansen. Yellowstone had been on fire. There was a heat wave and, you know, record high temperatures in parts of Europe and North America. So everything was kind of coalescing to create that moment. But 88 was the year, you know, for everybody in a way.
I mean, do you remember a moment where you sort of took in the magnitude of the problem, right? Where you sort of thought about all the players?
It was that year because by that time, you know, all of this was getting pretty consequential. There was really strange questions emerging. You know, for Russia, for the Soviet Union at that time, and for Maldives, 1,200 atolls, you know, these low sandy coral islands in the Indian Ocean. And the question of global warming was a very different question. Mm-hmm. Early 88, before Hansen's testimony and that kind of thing. They had the first international conference on the changing atmosphere. And here's this guy, Hussein Manikfan, who is the ambassador plenipotentiary to the UN from Maldives. And he just looked like a little lost lamb at this meeting. I remember having that feeling. He's wandering around, you know, all these big countries are talking about big things, and he was wondering whether they're going to be around for much longer. You know, I think back sometimes, like, how in the world could I have spent so much of my life writing about this the worst possible story,
right,
in many ways? You know, it's like, yeah, there's no clear villains and heroes. There are some, but they're not, they don't solve the problem.
Yeah.
So it's the worst possible story, literally. It's the hardest story to tell in a traditional journalistic frame. And how could I do this for this long? And the reason is it's the variegation and the depth and the profundity of it are really profoundly interesting.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, if you're on a slowly sinking ship, it gets your attention.
Yeah, yeah. And the pace of descent, you can keep
up
with.
Yeah, and I just, for whatever reason, I've just been kind of stuck with it ever since. It's like that Godfather movie where Al Pacino's like,
keep wanting to get out, and they keep sucking me back in.
It's like
I've never seen the movie.
Me.
I only know.
Yeah, but
that
there's that scene where it keeps sucking. It keeps pulling me back in, you know. And you know, here it is, a lot of years later, it's still pulling me back in.
Yeah. Wow. That's. I mean, so part of the reason I ask about that question of, you know, internalizing the magnitude of it, and some of the history here is because. This is going to sound like a little bit of a funny question and maybe a little devil's advocate, but, you know, do you believe that climate change is the most pressing problem facing the world today?
No.
Oh.
Climate change is a symptom of a much more profound story, which is this sort of halting coming of age of a young species on a finite planet. That it's like, you know, if a person is running a fever, the fever isn't the story, right?
Right.
The fever is a symptom of some dysfunction, some physiological imbalance. And to me, until we get to the deeper questions related to why it's hard for us to address this problem, and as I've written recently, why there is no we on planet Earth.
Yeah.
You know, if you're living in one of the slums I visited in Nairobi early this year, your energy and climate priorities are not the same as if you're living in Palo Alto.
Right.
And when you're poor, you have no interest in the future. You're all about today.
Yeah.
So that was a learning moment for me. I can't remember how many stories I've written with the word we in them.
Yeah.
To me, grappling with that bigger story, I wrote a piece like... I think the title was Puberty on the Scale of a Planet.
You know. It's a good title.
Well, and I think that's where we're kind of going through puberty on the scale of a planet, in the sense that...
It's awkward. Warmth where there didn't used to be warmth.
And fossil fuels are like testosterone. But here we are. You know, we've been plunked on this planet. We've been burning things for a long time. And then we stumbled into fossil fuels and like, oh, wow, this is really cool, you know?
Yeah, it's like a hormone.
Very dense, you know especially gasoline is awesome.
Yeah.
You know, portable, a lot of power density, and trying to replicate that in batteries, as Elon Musk has even said, is really hard. So it's like, and we've got all these toys, and so we're seduced by all that power and technology, and those who don't have that, even a tenth of that capacity, you know, the poor rural... or urbanizing Indian poor, you know, they need to think, they need more energy more than they need to worry about global warming. So it's like those, we
right.
are not going to address the global warming problem until we look at those deeper things. So that when I say it's not the most important thing, that's what I mean.
And
I feel strongly about it.
Yeah, no. Well, and that makes sense that there's a deeper disease of some sort or condition.
Condition, yeah.
Yeah. Right. I didn't mean to be prescriptive.
No. Well, you know, and again, some of us are, you know, there are people who wantonly are living lives of excess, and there are people who are trying hard to figure out how not to do that. So it's not like there's any we there either. You know, there is a disease-ish aspect to some of this, in the sense that, I don't know.
Greed run amok or something like
that.
Yeah,
I suppose you could say it's like there's still some who are so focused on financial wealth that they're willing to inoculate people with the disease,
right,
meaning hyperconsumption.
Right.
And,
well, okay, but even just sticking with that, is it fair then to, if there is a deeper condition that needs addressing, that the most acute symptom is this fever, global warming?
Well, that plus biological disruption, which
sure.
is happening.
Well, concurrently and interrelated.
And is devastating. You just look at the amphibian biota of Central America, and what's happening there is all a function of moving fungi around far more than it's a function of climate change and that kind of thing.
I think where I'm heading with this is Sometimes I feel like the audience for this show is really people who accept the basic tenets of the science, that we have to worry about climate change, but don't know what to make of it. And one of my starting points for trying to address that fear and concern is to think critically about why climate is important for reasons that we don't necessarily understand. Because I'm not sure we've actually done that job. I'm not sure the scientific community or the environmental journalism community has really sort of said, look, this is why we need to worry about climate. I mean, forget climate change.
Well, in fact, you could see scenarios where we don't need to worry about it. If we become rich and small and technologically able, we can live lives like I saw in Singapore this year, where they've got these gardens by the bay. It's this bizarre giant botanical garden thing with the world's largest, I think they're the world's largest enclosed glass domes. And there's a Mediterranean one. So you can go there and look at olive trees, and the temperature in this dome is like 68 degrees and the air is dry and you're like a few miles from the equator. And then next door you can go into the cloud forest dome, and it's like being in a museum of climates. And then if you go to so many cities in this in the world now where you're you hardly ever have to step outside. I wrote a piece a few years back on our increasing insulation from the climate system. So one approach is to just insulate ourselves from climate. And so that could, that, I mean, you could you have to kind of go to the extreme of saying there's a possibility of just where it really literally doesn't matter.
Right.
I mean, that's even beyond like the adaptation.
Yeah,
question.
No, I mean,
it's where you just seal it off. And but of course, it matters hugely, especially when you bring into play the fact that there's no we. That if you live in a semi-tropical area with a lot of rain-fed agriculture right now, that even today's climate extremes are a potent existential threat. So climate matters hugely. What I've been trying to get some there's some resistance I've found among environmentalists, particularly, to acknowledging that garden variety climate hazard is a profound real-time issue. Far more than climate change is right now, and even through till 2050 in some parts of the world. Really interesting paper by Tim Shanahan et al., paper in Science, 2009. A lake in Ghana, Bosumtwi, showed that for thousands of years there's been this like pattern of mega droughts. Not even a pattern. It's random, pretty random. But there are these mega droughts, some of which are like 100 or 200 years long. And they're way worse than anything that's happened in modern times, meaning hundreds of years. And they're sitting there waiting to happen, like completely scary droughts.
But centennial long.
So that's one thing. Yeah. So there's a history, a norm there of extreme drought. Mm. So that's one thing. Second thing is climate models, the most recent IPCC reports, are still equivocal on for that sort of peri-Saharan part of Africa, you know, those countries where poverty is so bad and dysfunctional governments are so bad that they don't know whether it's going to get wetter or drier. So okay, so you have profound drought is normal. We don't know, science doesn't know if greenhouse forest climate change is going to make it wetter or drier. But here's what we do know, that between now and 2050, we're doubling the population in those places. Two times more people, at least. And by late in the century, it could be even more than that. So when you look at that set of facts, those are facts. What's the first policy response you come up with? It's not constrained greenhouse gases, not for that particular scenario.
Right.
It's reduced vulnerability to climate hazard, period. Like, man, this is like a ticking. And by the way, you think about that in the context of migration pressure to Europe. The thing isn't, it's not climate change that's the issue. It could be if the one of the models that says drier, yeah, sure. But we don't know that. What you do know is that you have extreme vulnerability. You're doubling the vulnerability. You're doubling the risk by doubling the number of people, unless they become somehow magically less poor. So make them less poor. Find ways to manage water. Urbanize. Sort of urbanization is your friend. Find jobs for people in cities. Make sure the cities have sanitation and functional systems. That could also have a benefit for fertility rates. And it also means that family planning or getting girls through high school. This is why I don't say climate change is the most important thing in the world right now. If you live in that area, you look carefully and rigorously at the science and the demographic realities, you realize that the thing is vulnerability to hazard is the thing that's would keep me up at night. And that means that getting girls through school, which is the single best path to lower fertility rates,
right,
urbanization, which is also, those are the things to focus on.
I mean, does that make, that almost seems like everywhere you go, climate change is not the thing because there is no we. I mean, would you go that far?
Well, I do think it's really important to look at the circumstances in particular places. Yeah. You know, rising sea levels in an area of coastal storms will always exacerbate the impact of any particular storm. So if you're not ingrained, if you're not thinking about that deeply, then you're missing a driver of vulnerability. Yes, absolutely. But then, of course, here's the other, you know, inconvenient thing, which is commitment. The system is not, even if Al Gore ran the world starting tomorrow, there's a long period of lag before, of decades, before you could say that there was some, even a perceptible sort of modulation of trajectories of sea level or climate patterns. So that still says vulnerability is job one.
Yeah.
Even as we do the bigger thing of trying to decarbonize.
Yeah. I mean, I guess to be clear, like none of this is to take away from the, I assume, you know, your you would advocate heading towards a lower carbon future.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
right,
not to confuse the audience.
Yeah, no, it's really important because you know, especially, you know, then you get into the, what Steve Pakala at Princeton many, many years ago called the monsters behind the door, which is the worst case. It's there are these outsized hazards that come with unconstrained emissions, absolutely. And so it's imperative to get the world focused on how would you do that. And that leads to this whole, this is why, you know, this is the story of a lifetime, because it's, that leads to all these other questions about energy policy, innovation, deployment. And, but again, those are all, that's that subset of the story about decarbonization, which is, an imperative, but not, you know, again, that's on a timescale that to me is very detached from the timescale of the imperative of increasing resilience to hazard.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, so it's funny, though, because it does seem like a lot of the way, I mean, even if we, you know, scale down the problem and sort of come up with regional, local framings for environmental hazard and risk and vulnerability. I mean, a lot of it does seem sort of driven by a certain, I don't know, functionality, not utilitarianism, but I mean, there's not a whole lot of, like, you know, nature for nature's sake and loving nature. So where does environmentalism come into this?
Environmentalism definitely comes into this because one of the questions that would shape someone's priorities is how much do you care? Because I'm an environmentalist, you know. I want to have a functional, thriving planet for my boys and everyone else, you know, going forward in the century. You have to think about those things. And there are people creatively thinking about those with the timescales and sweep that's necessary, given, again, how much of this is going to play out that's not in our control. I've written about people who are trying to come up with a template for polar bear conservation by looking at sea ice behavior and sea ice models through 2100. It's pretty robustly understood where in the Arctic there will still be summer sea ice by the end of the century, even with a fast deterioration of the overall sea ice area in the Arctic Ocean. And so they've done the mapping and they say, well, here's a plan to create a resilient conservation strategy for polar bears by looking ahead. It's prospective conservation. You know, where in the Arctic will there be ice that will be good for polar bears in 2100 or 2075? And then you can start to build priorities based on that. It's a new kind of environmentalism. Mm-hmm. The old environmentalism had this sort of faux sense of, well, if we get everybody energized right now about global warming sufficiently, we'll end up with a really high carbon price and everyone will just magically decarbonize and global warming will be solved. And of course, that's not the way it's going to happen. Hmm. But there's a role, oh my God, you know, among the many, many, many things I've unlearned and learned is that all of the stances, if you don't have someone out there pushing for the ideal, then we're not going to get halfway to the ideal, you know? So overstatement, oversimplification is kind of the human way,
yeah.
Really. And if you try to tamp that down, not everyone is going to end up thinking and reacting and choosing a path on climate change, even among people who are really worried about it. There'll be there'll always be variety, and that's another thing I've written about increasingly, is that that's actually probably not such a bad thing. Would the world be better off if everyone was at one end of all this stuff? No, we do need it all. Yeah. We need to sort of embrace ourselves, including that uncomfortable reality that we're never, not only are we never all going to be the same, but that's actually a good thing.
It's a nice point to end on.
Oh, there's always more, but
yeah, no, you're a good talker.
Here's the thing, you know, I can't stop thinking about this stuff. So it's like, it is the ultimate, as a journalist or I keep running into scientists who are endlessly energized by this challenge we have right now. And I talk to young people. The great thing about having this ugly kind of x-dimensional problem, which a young scholar at Yale, Kelly Levin, years ago called super wicked in a paper. It's mm-hmm. a super wicked problem. The bad news is it's super wicked. It's insoluble, fundamentally. Mm-hmm. But the good news is that means everyone can do stuff. Like if you're a teacher or an artist or a musician or a host of a podcast or scientist or you know, whether you're a paleo person or a modeler or a social scientist especially or an inventor, you have something to do to tweak things toward betterment.
We're all in it.
Yeah.
So it is a big we.
In the end, there is a big we. We are all H sapiens, you know. And, as I say in my piece, can we live up to the sapiens in our name? The sapiens. We'll find out.
Andy Revkin, what a pleasure. Thank you for making the time, and best of luck with everything. I look forward to learning more as time moves on.
Yeah, and keep up the good casting.
This question of who the we is when we talk about the Anthropocene also came up in our conversation with science writer David Biello. Biello was an editor and reporter at Scientific American for over a decade, and he's currently science curator at TED Conferences, which is the organization behind TED Talks. David has just published a new book about the Anthropocene titled The Unnatural World: The Race to Remake Civilization in Earth's Newest Age. In his book, David goes on an incredible journey to learn how people are tackling the large-scale challenges we face across our changing planet. Each chapter of his book tells a story of individuals who are at the forefront of developing ambitious plans and technologies to help solve planetary problems. From geoengineering to carbon-free cities to hybrid landscapes and travels into space, in every sense of the word, these are Anthropocene stories. Here's our producer, Miles Traer, with David Biello.
In his new book, David Biello takes the reader on a tour of the planet to identify the critical questions and solutions facing the environment in the 21st century. Like many environmentalists today, he believes that confronting the challenges we face will require a fundamental shift in human nature.
The challenges are not so much in the natural world, but are inside us as people, that it's human nature that requires the biggest change rather than the world around us.
The concept of the Anthropocene is woven throughout the book. This is the unnatural world, after all. But while Biello believes that the term itself is useful, he's concerned that when we lump all of humanity into one word, it runs the risk of masking important cultural and political disparities in power. When people say that we are causing changes to Earth's surface, who exactly is that we?
And the reason that I think Anthropocene has stuck is that there is a very special subset of people who are most responsible for the big changes that have happened to this planet in the last 150 years. So if there is a we that is responsible for the Anthropocene, it is most likely the same we that kind of dominates science of the last 150 years. And that we is not all-inclusive of humanity. It is a subset thereof. That said, all of humanity is having an impact on the planet.
His book grapples with a theme that we encounter frequently. How do we develop conservation strategies when intellectually we know that the boundary between humans and nature is virtually impossible to define? That our perceived separation from nature is just that, a perception. This has consequences for how we protect biodiversity in a time when extinctions are on the rise.
So ecology is a very fraught concept where we're kind of fighting it out on a philosophical level, but also on a very practical level around how we're going to keep as many species with us as we possibly can. And what's the best way to do that? Is it to take kind of the vacant lot approach and just let whatever is going to happen happen? Or is it a more interventionist approach?
Biello believes that one reason we've been so slow to respond to environmental challenges is that we've become too susceptible to doom and gloom narratives. That's not to say that these narratives aren't appropriate, but for him, these narratives have lost our appreciation for nature.
And some of that wonder and awe comes from kind of scientific discovery and the rest of it. The wonder and awe, the sacredness of the natural world, that's something that we cannot lose. And if we do lose it, then I start to subscribe to some of those doom and gloom narratives. But the idea of backing off of technology is hard to see when the problems that we're facing are so large.
The role of technology in our solutions to today's problems is another theme that's woven throughout the book. There's a real tension between groups who feel that technology must lead the way, while others feel that it's making a treacherous situation worse. So, what are we to make of our relationship to technology?
Electricity freed us from so many bad things, and part of the problem that we're trying to solve right now is how to bring the 2 billion people in the world who don't have access to modern energy into that high energy lifestyle, because frankly, cutting down forests to burn it for cooking fuel or heat is not a good use of that forest and is exacerbating the kind of biodiversity loss that we don't want to see. The forests are regrowing in the United States because we've been able to have industrialized agriculture, and the power from coal has enabled us to bring back the forests. That's quite a change from 50 years ago. And that was in part enabled by this modern high energy lifestyle. And we need to help the world get to that place so that we can bring along as many of our fellow travelers on this planet as possible, at least from my point of view.
Once again, David Biello's book is titled The Unnatural World, The Race to Remake Civilization in Earth's Newest Age. Our show is produced by Mike Osborne, Miles Traer, and me, Leslie Chang. Additional production help this week from Jackson Roach and Isha Salian. If you have any comments or feedback about the show or any story ideas, please get in touch. We'd love to hear from you, and you can email us at genanthropocene@gmail.com, and we're also on Twitter at genanthropocene. Our theme music is by Maserati, and our website is genanthro.com. As always, we want to thank Tom Hayden and Pam Mattson. This is our last episode for the year. Thanks as always for listening. Happy holidays, happy new year, and we have a bunch more stories about the Anthropocene that we're really excited to share with you next year. So we will see you back in 2017.